Today, President Biden is using his clemency powers to commute the sentences of 37 of the 40 people on federal death row. The 37 individuals, who are all men, will now serve life in prison without parole. It's one of the most significant moves against capital punishment in recent presidential history. And here to talk through the news is NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Good morning, Deepa.
Hey, good morning.
So what has President Biden said about this decision?
Well, the president put out a statement this morning, and he laid out a couple of points. He was clear in saying that he condemns the people convicted of murder who are on federal death row, and he grieves with the victims who have suffered because of them. Mm-hmm. But he says his decision to commute the sentences for the 37 men was guided by his conscience, his experience as a public defender, his time as a senator, vice president, and president. And Biden said, quote, "I am more convinced than ever that we must stop the use of the death penalty at the federal level." And just a couple things to keep in mind here, Asma. Biden commuted the sentences of these 37 men to life in prison. So that's different than granting a pardon, right? Mm-hmm, these men will still be guilty for the crimes they committed. They will not be eligible for any kind of parole. And the other thing to remember is that Biden's actions here only apply to those facing the federal death penalty. There are still people on death row in different states, though. Mm-hmm. And of course, three of the 40 men on federal death row, Biden did not commute their sentences.
So tell us more about those three men. Who are they?
Yeah, so these are very specific, pretty high-profile cases that involved terrorism or hate-fueled mass murder. So that includes Robert Bowers, who was convicted for the 2018 mass shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue, Dylan Roof, convicted for the 2015 mass shooting at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, and Zokar Sarnaev, who was convicted of the 2013 bombing at the Boston Marathon. Those three men will remain on federal death row.
Deepa, I think this is all really interesting because I recall covering President Biden's campaign, and back during that 2020 presidential election cycle, he said that he opposed the death penalty, but he has not taken a whole lot of action as president on this issue until now. How much pressure was he facing to do this?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of calls for Biden to use his clemency powers for those on death row, from criminal justice advocates to people like Pope Francis. And it really bubbled up more after he pardoned his own son, Hunter Biden, who was convicted of tax and gun charges. Mm-hmm. And after that happened, Biden used his clemency powers to pardon 39 people who had been convicted of nonviolent crimes. He commuted the sentences of about 1,500 people who had been on home confinement during the COVID-19 pandemic. But advocates considered those actions to be pretty small overall, and they were really waiting on Biden and calling on him to take this big step on the death penalty here. And I will say the reaction to this new announcement has been pretty positive so far. Advocates like Brian Stevenson, who is known for his advocacy for fighting for innocent folks on death row, praised Biden for his decision. And he said it sends a message that the death penalty isn't the answer to concerns about public safety.
Just briefly here, how much of Biden's decision was also impacted by how the incoming Trump administration might handle federal executions?
Yeah, I mean, Biden took pretty sweeping action here on the death penalty compared to previous Democratic presidents. And he did kind of hint at the incoming Trump administration for why he made this decision. Mm-hmm. Back in 2021, Biden put a moratorium on federal executions, but that could have been undone by Trump. And mm-hmm. Biden said he didn't want to stand back and let a new administration resume executions that he halted.
That's NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The National Institutes of Health recently announced it's investing $300 million to research treatments for long COVID. In total, the agency has directed $1.8 billion towards studying the virus and its after effects, which is associated with extreme fatigue, brain fog, and heart problems. But many patients are frustrated that researchers haven't come up with a reliable treatment yet. For more on this, I'm joined now by health reporter Sarah Bowden. Good morning, Sarah.
Hey, good morning.
So, Sarah, $300 million, it sounds like a substantial amount of money. Why are patient groups still not pleased with this?
Yeah, so the NIH has funded hundreds of different kinds of studies on long COVID, but just 8 of those studies have been clinical trials looking at possible treatments, and patient advocacy groups say this pace is just way too slow. And also they feel that there's been too much focus in trying to understand why people get sick with long COVID, but not enough attention on trying to relieve their suffering, helping them feel better. And somebody who I've talked to a lot about this is someone named Megan Stone, who is the executive director of the Long COVID campaign.
There really is a burden to make up this lost time now. Millions of Americans can't keep waiting and keeping their lives on pause or even dying, you know, with this condition. Like, we really do need to see progress.
Mm. Also, I'll note, Asma, that an estimated 17 million adults in the U.S. have long COVID, and that means many of them are unable to work or care for their families. Mm. And that is why some consider the COVID pandemic a mass disabling event. Mm.
So, Sarah, what does the NIH say about these criticisms?
Well, the agency agrees that there is a real urgency to find treatments, but they told me that scientists need a solid understanding of the underlying biology of long COVID, which is a complicated disease that can damage nearly every organ system. And researchers have learned a lot. For example, one NIH-funded study found that people are less likely to get long COVID if they've been vaccinated. And I talked to one NIH-funded researcher, Dr. Lior Horowitz. She's at NYU. And she told me that, you know, you have to remember, we're only 5 years into this pandemic. And there is real concern that jumping into clinical trials too soon might not be safe. It could waste money. It could waste time. But it is also true that so far, we still don't have any FDA-approved drugs or devices or any therapies specifically for long COVID.
Mm. So how are patients coping in the meantime?
Well, for a lot of people, their only option is to go on long-term disability while they keep trying different drugs and therapies to manage their symptoms. And patients tell me they're exhausted, they're frustrated, and doctors feel this way too. For example, Dr. Michael Broad at UT Health Austin, he says there's a lot of guesswork in treating long COVID because there's just not enough research.
I'm in this terrible position of I don't want to hype up a treatment that is still experimental, but I also don't want to hide it.
Broad also told me he prescribes medications that are not approved by the FDA for long COVID, but they are approved for other illnesses. This is called off-label prescribing. And often insurance companies don't cover these prescriptions, and that leaves very sick people having to decide whether to pay out of pocket for treatment.
Thanks so much, Sarah, for your reporting.
Thank you.
That's health and science journalist Sarah Bowden. She's a member of NPR's KFF Health News Collaboration. Lebanon is a small country chock full of antiquities, Greco-Roman ruins, Crusader castles, Ottoman architecture. And some of it was damaged in the war there this fall between Israel and Hezbollah militants. Christmas Day marks 1 month since a ceasefire took effect in Lebanon. In addition to the more than 4,000 people who were killed there, according to Lebanon's health ministry, officials are still assessing damage to cultural heritage sites. NPR international correspondent Lauren Freyer recently visited several of those sites, and she joins us now. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning, Asma.
So tell us about what you saw at the places you visited.
Yeah, I went into areas of southern Lebanon that saw the fiercest fighting of the war. In some cases, Israeli soldiers and Hezbollah militants were fighting inside Crusader castles. Mm. I saw Byzantine fortifications of a walled old city destroyed by an Israeli airstrike, churches and mosques that had been hit. These are some of the iconic sites you see on postcards of Lebanon. But Israel accuses Hezbollah of hiding weapons and fighters in some of them. In mid-November, the United Nations added 34 sites in Lebanon to its list of protected cultural properties, hoping to prevent damage to them.
Do those protections hold?
No, I mean, at least not for all of them. I went to a 3,000-year-old castle in a place called Tibnin near the boundaries of Syria, Lebanon, and Israel. One of its Crusader-era walls had crumbled. I climbed to the roof. It was littered with debris from Israeli airstrikes on homes nearby. And I was with a municipal official named Ali Fawaz. He was seeing the damage for the first time, and he was emotional. He said he felt very sad.
Very sad. It's a very important place. It's our history. So you feel from inside something who cut it from you.
This castle's been the pride of his community literally for centuries, and to him, this damage is priceless.
You know, Lauren, in war, cultural sites are meant to be protected by all parties in a conflict. So what is the extent of the damage here you're seeing?
Lebanon's six UNESCO World Heritage Sites are marked with this blue and white symbol that signifies UN protection. It's even painted on the roof of the ticket office so that it's visible by warplanes. I visited three of the six UNESCO heritage sites. The monuments themselves are still standing, but for example, an Israeli airstrike left a crater in the tourist parking lot right next to some Greco-Roman temples in Baalbek. Archaeologists have yet to x-ray the columns for hairline fractures from the force of explosions all around them. There's also damage to historic stone houses, ancient markets. Joanne Farshuk-Bajali is a specialist in heritage architecture who's been going around to properties on Lebanon's National Register of Historic Places to literally see if they're still there.
If you start removing all these houses, within a few years there will be no memories left and the history will become a myth. But when you keep monuments standing, then you can actually keep the history alive.
You know, she sees this damage as an Israeli attempt to erase Lebanon's claim to its history and its own land. Israel, of course, denies that. Just like in Gaza, it says its intention has not been to lay waste to residential areas, only that it's responding to militant attacks that come from these same areas.
Mm. Lauren, what are the prospects of rebuilding?
I mean, the World Bank estimates that in Lebanon, the cost of damage and economic losses from the war to be about $8.5 billion. So rebuilding will be a huge years-long project. This is a country that the economy has already been in shambles before this war. And that rebuilding can't begin in a lot of these areas until Israeli troops withdraw. And that hasn't finished yet. There are areas still where civilians cannot get home in Lebanon and where they can't reach antiquities either.
That is NPR's international correspondent, Lauren Freyer. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Asma. Happy holidays.
You too.